From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 377 for December 4th, 2011. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. Looking forward to speaking with you today. Was off last week. We had the hockey game on, and this week we're here till 5. Call in early, be able to answer your questions and discuss any issues that you would like to bring up. One that I would like to bring up is an article that is making the rounds, published everywhere. This particular one I got from Time. In Europe, and we talked about this earlier, in the year, where they were concerned about measles outbreaks on the rise in Europe. Well, it continues apace. They are now up to 26,000 cases this year and 9 deaths in Europe. We shouldn't be seeing any cases in Europe and 0 deaths. They're up to 26,000. France accounts for 14,000 of those cases, mainly in children older than 5 and in young adults. The other big outbreaks have been identified in Spain, Romania, Macedonia, and although not in Europe, Uzbekistan. It has killed 9 people in Europe and as well hospitalized thousands of others. And it was published, this report on the numbers was published this past Thursday by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Up until about 2009, measles cases had been dropping, but then in late 2009, they noticed this sharp increase. And they're stating that this has been due to the low vaccination rates, and about half the cases were in people older than 15. When you think about it, the false and now discredited study by Andrew Wakefield that was published in 1998 in The Lancet that had claimed to link MMR vaccine with autism caused a great sensation and concern amongst parents who abdicated vaccinating their children for measles, mumps, and rubella. And this has resulted now, we're 13 years later, with increasing measles rates, in particular in Europe. And part of the problem is that when people travel, it brings the measles virus over to other countries. So in the United States, they have had 205 cases this year, the most in a decade, and virtually all are linked to other regions, including 20 cases from Europe. And because we have very few measles outbreaks here, although we have had several hundreds in clusters around the country and in the United States, each case in the United States anyway, each case that is reported requires a thorough investigation and response that costs tens of thousands of dollars for each case. So you can imagine how much money this takes out of the system that really doesn't have to happen if these were prevented in the first place. And in comparison, the U.S. normally has about 50 cases a year. Very infectious disease. 90% of people that are exposed to the virus will get sick if they are not protected from it. And the droplets that are spread from coughing, sneezing, and such can linger up to 2 hours after the sick person leaves a room. So, as I said, it is well designed to infect people. It kills 1 to 2 children for every 1,000 that are infected. So remember, we have 26,000 measles cases. So you are going to have a certain number of deaths from that. And it can also cause pregnant women to have miscarriages or premature births. In 2008, there were 164,000 measles deaths worldwide, 95% occurring in poor countries. So the idea that somehow measles is gone, we don't have to vaccinate, or that somehow if we vaccinate, we're going to cause harm to our children, the actual reverse is true. When you vaccinate, you actually prevent them from getting sick. You prevent them from developing complications, not only death, but pneumonia, meningitis, ear infections, all sorts of other things that occur, that some being life-threatening, some being inconvenient. But nevertheless, it's a lot of people. And if this was any other disease, any other rare type disease, you could bet this would be sensationalized in the headlines, creating mass fear. Whereas this measles being very commonplace, or at least we don't see measles very much at all in North America. We don't see the end result of the damage, and thus we don't take this as a major problem. And for many people, they say, well, I don't see that there's a problem. No need to vaccinate. Well, when you don't vaccinate, what you're seeing in Europe will happen very clearly here if we follow the same route. I also wanted to review very quickly, and Lowell Green talked about this a bit earlier in the week about mammograms and the screening for breast cancer. And he had cited, and a lot of people will use this argument, that they know of young women who have developed breast cancer for whom they had a mammogram and it saved their lives. And I believe it. You know, I have no reason to suspect that the claim is false, that it will find breast cancers in young women. And this, we're talking about women. In this case, the recommendations were 40 to 49. Sometimes we find it in women that are younger than that, but those are very rare. You can certainly cite and know that there's someone that, and no friends or family that may have had this, but nevertheless, it's still a rare occurrence. Well, the Canadian Task Force on Preventive Care came out with a recommendation that said that screening women between 40 and 49 for breast cancer was actually more harmful than good. And again, you'll cite, and again, rightly so, you'll cite, I know that there's someone who had screening and it helped them. But when you look at the actual data for the screening, you're looking at, and when you cite that there's one person you know that was helped by it, that's the top of the iceberg. What happens underneath the iceberg is the following. If you're screening a woman every 2 years for 10 to 11 years, and this is called the number needed to screen, the number that you need to screen to prevent one death for women between the ages of 40 to 49 is 2,108 to find one person who has breast cancer that you can prevent their death. But from that, 690 of those women will have false positives, meaning that they don't have breast cancer. And from those 690, 75 will have surgical procedures or biopsies in order to evaluate whether it's true or not. So you're having a lot of invasive procedures done. You're causing a lot of unnecessary fear and anxiety and distress in that group. And when we come back from the break, I'm going to finish up on the numbers just to give you comparisons when you deal with the older age groups and how that number needed to screen diminishes and the benefit tends to improve. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back with your calls and just the finishing up on breast cancer screening in just a few moments.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And welcome back. I just wanted to finish up on the screening evaluations for breast cancer. And this applies also to other screening tests. And I'll get into what we really have to look for with regards to screening, because again, you don't want screening tests to turn healthy people into patients unnecessarily, and all that implies once you are deemed a patient with regards to workup, investigations, the emotional impact, social impact, effect on the family. It's not a small thing. And so in this case, again, when we're talking about breast cancer, and when I made these comments to earlier on during health headlines in the morning, the issue is that once you publish data like this, you end up, instead of dispassionately looking at the information, you have groups that will rise up and scream and complain. You know, understandable that people are going to be upset when a certain worldview is turned around or information is presented that is contrary to what you believe to be true, but may not necessarily be true. And again, the end goal is not to harm people. It's to save people's lives and reduce the morbidity from disease. And so in this case, again, with breast cancer screening, the recommendations really have not changed very much with regards to what we do in Ontario, but it was made to be this big issue. Over 10 years, again, a 10-year time frame, doing mammograms every 2 years. If you are 40 to 49 years old, the number that will need to be screened to save one life is 2,108. Of those, 690 will be told that they have potential cancer when they don't, and 206 of them, 75 of them will require unnecessary biopsies, breast biopsies. That's the data. When you move up to age 50 to 69, that number you need to screen drops from 2,100 over 10 years to save one life to 721. But even from those 721, 204 will have false positives, and there will be about 26 unnecessary biopsies. And for women 70 to 74, the number drops from 721 down to 451 to screen every 2 years for 10 years to save one life. False positive results, 96 cases, and 11 unnecessary biopsies. So breast cancer being more common in older women, it does occur in younger women, but it is much more common in older women, as you can see that the number you need to screen diminishes over time in order to save a life. And so you have to ask, and this is where we ask the question, at what point, where is the balance point for screening when, again, you are harming a lot of women, you are harming many women, both emotionally and physically, to save one life when you do screening at a much younger age. That's all that they are saying. These are recommendations. They're not saying it must happen. It's simply presenting the information for us then to debate and talk about what is acceptable with regards to screening, in this case for breast cancer. And these kind of evaluations go on for other screening evaluations as well. I want to go to the phone lines and welcome John from Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not bad. I got a question to ask you about bronchitis now.
Yes.
I think I have a history of this. Can you tell me what it is?
Well, first thing I have to ask you is, do you smoke?
I did in the past, yes, for about 7 years.
Okay, and how long have you not been smoking?
9 years.
Oh, so that's terrific. Okay. Well, bronchitis, by definition, refers to an inflammation of the tubes that run into your lung. These are called bronchi. These are the large tubes that move air into the lungs. You have one main bronchus that comes down into the chest, divides into two to go into the right and left lung, and then it keeps dividing and dividing, just like a tree would. When you start at the trunk, and then the branches branch off, and you have more branches, then you have the leaves. Right. So bronchitis is an inflammation of those tubes. The most common type of bronchitis is, well, I should back up. Again, it means an inflammation of the tubes. Inflammation can be from irritation of the lungs, so breathing in chemical compounds that are corrosive can cause damage to the airway and cause a bronchitis. Infections can do this as well. And then from the infection standpoint, there's viral and bacterial causes. Most commonly for people who do not smoke, they get viral bronchitis. And the reason they don't get bacterial bronchitis is because their lungs are functioning very well. They tend to be able to clear out the lungs and airway very efficiently. And it's not very common to see bacteria land in there and cause damage, because the lungs themselves are not damaged in someone who does not smoke, or for that matter, someone who hasn't smoked for 9 years. Your lungs are pretty much healed up.
Yeah. So can you tell me why I'm getting this now? I think the last time I had it was 2008 with bronchitis and asthma at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of times what happens is that people are told they have bronchitis when they actually have asthma. And there are two separate types of diagnoses. Asthma is also an inflammatory condition of the airways. It causes inflammation of the bronchi as well. It causes mucus to be produced. And it also makes the airways around the tubes themselves, there are muscles that will squeeze down or relax the tubes to allow air to flow through. And when someone has a viral infection, if they have asthma, it can exacerbate the asthma. It can irritate the airway and it tends to over-respond. That is, it tends to get more inflamed with more mucus production than someone who doesn't have asthma. And so a lot of times people will be told that they have bronchitis when they really have asthma. And the treatment for someone who has asthma is usually inhalers to be able...
Yeah, I've done that once before, yeah.
Yeah. And also sometimes if the asthma is due to allergy-mediated problems, it's either the avoidance of certain things that cause allergies or changes in the environment, changes in the home, getting rid of carpeting, pets, etc., that could sometimes exacerbate that condition. But again, for bronchitis, bronchitis is sort of a catch-all term. It's like saying you have a cold. Bronchitis simply means inflammation of the airway, but the question that follows from that is what has caused that inflammation of that airway. And so although asthma does that, asthma is a specific diagnosis that can cause inflammation of the airway, which means you do have a form of bronchitis, but it's the asthma itself that's the diagnosis. Bronchitis is not a diagnosis in and of itself.
Okay. Is it possible that I could have had this for about 2-3 weeks and I finally went to my doctor 2 days on Wednesday? She diagnosed it as bronchitis right now and I'm on antibiotics. Is there a way of knowing about this before? Because I was coughing really deep for a few weeks before I realized I better get to a doctor.
Well, usually, bacterial bronchitis is quite rare to see in someone who is not smoking. In fact, that I didn't examine you, so I don't know exactly. But if someone is coughing, but they are not bringing up dark green, smelly gobs of sputum all the time, then it's unlikely that they have bacterial bronchitis.
Okay.
A lot of times, an inhaler is used, and there's several forms of inhalers that are used. And if that calms the cough down, especially if you've had this for 3 weeks, keep in mind that bacteria will reproduce themselves and double every 20 minutes. So if somebody has a bacterial infection in their chest, you would expect that condition to get worse very quickly over several days, which is exactly why when people get pneumonias or ear infections or strep throat or tonsillitis, it's something that occurs very quickly and presents itself quite blatantly. As opposed to viral infections, which will cause, you know, which can cause similar symptoms, but they tend to hover. They don't really get, they get worse for a certain point, then it stops and it sort of stays constant and then goes down.
Okay. What happens if this doesn't get treated? Obviously, this has to get treated.
Well, if it's due to asthma, then you have to treat the asthma. If it's virally mediated, you have to remember that viral coughs, especially from cold viruses, can sometimes last 6 to 8 weeks, whether you do something or not. So the question, just using me as an example, when I get viral infections that gives me a cold, I will get a cough that sometimes will go for weeks on end and I have to use an inhaler to calm the cough down. But I don't use an antibiotic because there's no bacteria to treat in that. No. So I would, you know, and if you're still coughing and it's been 2 days that you've been on the antibiotic, then you don't have bacterial bronchitis because that should have helped clear that up relatively quickly for you.
Yeah, because I'm still coughing right now, but not as bad. And it's been 1, 2, 3, 4 days in and it wraps up on Wednesday when I go back to my doctor.
Yeah, and if you're still coughing, it's unlikely that it's bacterial bronchitis. It's likely virally mediated. There may be an asthmatic component given that you had that diagnosis in the past.
Yeah.
And so the treatment, are you using any inhalers?
No.
I would probably...
This is straight, not pale.
Yeah, I would likely use inhalers. Even if someone had bacterial bronchitis, you would give them an inhaler just to calm the airway down. So you may want to speak to your physician about trying the inhalers to see if that helps you.
One more thing. If this is a lifetime thing, then I'm always going to get this now.
It is very possible if you do have a diagnosis of asthma, and that has to be confirmed by your physician, but if there is a mild asthma, then every time you get a viral infection, you're likely to have this kind of cough.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, John.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break. And when we come back, we also have John in Ottawa who'd like to talk about heart medications and side effects. And Andrew in Ottawa has a question about a nephrology procedure. The rest of our lines are available. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. Looking forward to speaking with you in the next half hour. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be right back after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going straight back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to John in Ottawa.
Yes, good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I'm going to ask you a strange question, and it's going to be a little bizarre. When your body starts to reject and starts to have severe reactions to heart medication or to any kind of medication, and the doctor feels that your cardiologist or your doctor feels their odds of trying to work with you are very limited, in the sense they're frustrated. They don't know what kind of medication to mm-hmm. issue you anymore. Is that the way that the body literally is starting to shut down and literally saying enough is enough? I can't take this medication anymore.
Well, usually we have to deal with two separate issues from this. The first is whether the medication has lost its effectiveness because the underlying disease that is being treated is getting worse. And so the mm-hmm. medications become less effective, or they're just not powerful enough to counter the normal progression of the disease. And the other side of that is whether the medications are causing side effects that are intolerable. And so those are the two sides to those things. So if, for example, someone is being treated for a cardiac condition or heart condition that is known to deteriorate over time despite treatment, where the treatment only delays the progression of the disease. That is, it slows down the deterioration, but the end result is instead of deteriorating over 5 years, a person may deteriorate in 10 years. But there is a point where those medications may not do the job anymore, and there may not be any medications to replace those to try to bolster or provide what we call a therapeutic or helpful benefit. So there's that aspect of it, and the frustration comes usually from not being able to help the person, that they've run out of options with regards to what is available to treat the condition. The other aspect is that if someone is taking medications for the condition and they're having allergic reactions where they develop rashes or hives, or they can't breathe properly because they get an asthma-like reaction, those are things where you try to find other medications that provide somewhat equivalent effect without causing that reaction. But again, if someone, and rarely does this happen, where someone is taking multiple medications, different classes of medications, and reacts to all of them, but if that does indeed happen, then again, the end result is that the options are very limited.
I see, because the thing is that right now I'm on Pradax, and I'm on water pills, and my cardiologist literally has cut down some of the strongest medication to give me because I'm having severe reactions. And literally with the work with the pharmacist, he's sort of wondering, what else can I give this guy? I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sort of stuck. If I give him strong medication, it literally can provoke him a heart attack. So I'm sort of stuck now. I'm giving him weaker medication that's not mm-hmm. It's not a cure, but literally trying to keep him alive. And that's all I can do. It's just basically trying to keep this guy alive. And that's what I'm wondering, because the medication I'm taking is not as strong as the stuff that I used to take, because right. I used to have severe reactions.
Okay.
And now now I'm starting to have severe reactions with Pradax now. And literally it's starting to accelerate my heart rate. And now I'm stuck. I'm continuing on Pradax mm-hmm. to the point where if I feel that it's literally going to force my heart to the point where it's going to come out of my chest, then I'm going to have to speak to him. But I don't know what. I'm just wondering if that's the way the body is sort of literally shutting down and saying enough is enough.
I don't think it's a matter of shutting down. I think it's a matter of how the condition was originally being controlled and the changes that are occurring over time. But it doesn't necessarily mean things are shutting down. What I would also recommend, and you've already mentioned it, is that you speak with your cardiologist about the symptoms that you're having.
Yes.
Pradax usually, especially if you've had more than one medication change done at the same time, If that's what's happened, it may not necessarily be the products that's giving you the effect that you're experiencing. It could be the fact that they changed other medications or reduced other medications that now are allowing some of those symptoms to come out a bit more strongly. So, yes. So there's that aspect as well that has to be looked at. But what you're describing, John, is a more complex matter, and you really, and they're great questions that you asked, and the insight that you have is excellent, and you have to bring that up with your cardiologist and make them listen to what you're saying to get an answer to solutions to say, look, what can we do to make things a bit better? What is it, what do you think is going on, and how do you, what solutions? And, you know, it's okay for someone to say to you, I don't have the answers, but you need to have at least an answer from them to know what is on their minds and what their plan is in terms of your management.
I see. And I'd like to ask you one final question, and I'll let you go and take care of your next patient. Like I said, he's pushed a defibrillator enormously, and I sent you some emails, and I'm sure you've seen them. There's one that, is there a defibrillator that you're that you know, or a website you can recommend me that I could take a look? Because I saw one in California at the University, the Heart Institute in California. There's one that they can literally, they have installed wires near the heart, and literally, and it works on the inside and on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Is there one on the market that you know of, or you could recommend that can be installed from the outside?
Well, usually they usually will put pacemakers inside, because the danger is if you have a device outside of the heart, outside of the chest wall, wires have to run into the chest. And when you have wires running into the chest, the issue then becomes tracking infection inside the body cavity. So there's that aspect of it. Most pacemakers are put just underneath the skin. It doesn't go into the, it doesn't go under your ribs. It usually goes just on top of the ribs. And the wires that run then are already, they're sterile, and they run directly in the chest cavity without having any risk of transmitting or carrying bacteria into the heart or around the heart. And they are quite effective. I'm certainly no expert on pacemakers, but I do know that the pacemakers that are available here, you have to keep in mind, are the ones that are approved for use in Canada and the ones that the hospitals will tend to use. So if they are recommending something for you that will provide a benefit, if they can tell you that it will make things better for you, I would certainly consider that. You know, they wouldn't be offering this to you if they didn't think it was going to work. It's not a procedure. You don't do invasive procedures on people just to try to make them feel better from a psychological standpoint. You want to do something that will have a direct impact on their physical health as well.
The only problem, I'm a coward. I'm afraid of any kind of, I'm not afraid of dental surgery, but
yes.
When it comes to something like this, I'm literally a coward. I'm
well, you have
terrified.
To, you have to keep in mind that this is not open heart surgery. They're not going to break open your chest to do this. So it's very different when using pacemakers. It's not the same kind of surgery. Mm-hmm. But this is where you have to sometimes overcome the fear by considering the risk and benefit of the procedure. And the way that can help is by having somebody, in this case your cardiologist, providing you with the complete information of the risk of not doing anything versus the risk of doing something, and also the risk entailed with the procedure and knowing what the outcomes are. But ultimately, if there is an offer of a particular solution that may also make a big difference with regards to not having to use many medications that are causing this problem.
I see. Well, thank you very much for your time. I'm sorry I wasted it.
You're not wasting it at all, John. Thanks for calling. I hope this was helpful for you.
Oh, you did. You answered some very good questions for me. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye
now. And we're going to go to line 3, and good afternoon to Andrew in Ottawa.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. I've got a question for you with regard to a program that you did maybe a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
To do with nephrology. Some kind of procedure, I think, that was done on an infant in the UK. That's a new procedure.
Oh, this was a liver, not kidney. This was a transplant of liver cells that they encapsulated in this algae type material that prevented the body from attacking these liver cells. This particular boy, he was 9 years old. He had liver failure, and he was going to die because there was no liver transplant available. and the liver was failing, and you couldn't do anything to help him out. So what they did is they used these cells, liver cells, that they put into his body that functioned like a liver, that is in effect allowed his own liver to repair itself. It gave it that lead time for his own liver to take back what it had lost and resume its function. And what happened is that he had a normal functioning liver after a while because of this procedure. It helped avoid liver transplant and gave him the breathing room to allow his liver to heal up. But it wasn't the kidneys in this case, it was the liver.
Oh, I'm totally misheard. One more thing.
Sure.
I consume a lot of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, I don't have any side effects, no diabetes, nothing like that. But could you recommend one or two good substitutes for sugar that aren't, let's say, doesn't have an aftertaste
mm-hmm.
and is not carcinogenic?
Well, the sugar substitute that I'll tell you the one I use because I find it works for cooking and everything else is sucralose. And that is under the... You know, I don't like saying brand names, but I think there's only one company that makes it. So the company that makes sucralose is Splenda. Called Splenda.
I tried that. I still find it has an aftertaste.
It can potentially have that, but I find that it depends on what you're using it for. You know, if you're adding sugar to things, you may get a little bit, but I'll bet you that if you use it for a little while, that type of aftertaste becomes something you get used to, and it just sort of doesn't become a problem anymore.
No side effects? Or...
There's all it is a sugar molecule that has been changed a little bit to remain in the intestine that does not get absorbed, but it's essentially a sugar molecule that was just altered a tiny bit.
And so, does it have less calories as well?
There's no calories. So that's the advantage. And if you're consuming lots of sugar, extra calories means extra weight over time.
Yes.
And that's the issue. And especially, and you bring up a great point, Andrew, is that people don't realize, although you have, but a lot of people don't realize, you know, the number of coffees or teas or things that they have during the day when they add cream and sugar to it, those are calories that we don't even think about. And those are actually the ones that are in part responsible for weight gain over time. If someone's having two or three coffees a day at 50 calories extra from stuff that are put in, that's 150 calories. That's a lot of calories. That's 4,500 calories a month. That's over a pound in terms of energy a month.
One more thing. Talking about cream.
Yes.
Okay. What about a substitute for cream?
It depends on, you know, you basically want to look for something that's low fat. You're never going to get away from zero calories with regards to cream. So you want to choose something that is as low calorie as possible and how much you're using. So it really does boil down to, or use milk instead of cream. And that'll reduce the calorie count.
Something like Coffee Mate.
You can take a look and see what kind of calories are in there just to be sure that you're not actually adding as many calories as you would for just adding the milk or the cream in there. But it's worthwhile just to read the labels to see what it's going to give you and actually measure out so you know exactly how much you're actually putting in. Because a lot of people, they just spill it in and they don't know exactly how much is going in. But as an experiment, just to do it would give you an idea of the calories. And then you can measure apples with apples with regards to the Coffee Mate.
Super. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Andrew.
Bye-bye.
All the best now. And when we come back, we have Janet in Ottawa who has a body rash and severe itching. Mimi and Elmer would like to talk about breast cancer screening, and Diane in Orangeville, Ontario would like to discuss shingles. And we'll get to your calls right after the break. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you are listening to Sunday House Call.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
So call me Dr.
CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're going to go straight back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Janet in Ottawa.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I'm calling about this rash that I've had for over a month,
mm-hmm.
and the itching is severe, and I have had medicated cream, I have had pills, I'm using, a cream with oatmeal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just getting worse and worse, and it's all over me, back, front, arms, and I'm sort of, my thought now is I should be going to an allergist, I think.
Mm-hmm. Is the area above your neck affected?
Not above my neck.
Okay, so that's actually very important because that's telling us that whatever it is that is affecting you, likely is more from contact as opposed to ingesting something.
Okay.
Because if you have something that you ingest, it usually would go everywhere. There's no reason for it not to go above the neck.
Okay.
There's blood supply above the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does it also tend to follow, like for example, are your hands affected or is it the, or are there parts of your arms that aren't affected and other parts that are affected?
The lower parts are affected and around the shoulders are affected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then from your elbow to the shoulder, there's not as much.
Well, there's some, not as much, but there's some, yeah.
Oh, okay. So this usually requires almost a type of investigation that is to do some legwork to identify what could possibly have occurred
mm-hmm.
1 month ago, since this was 1 month ago, what changed in your environment
mm-hmm.
to be able to contribute to this?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times it's some compound that has touched your body.
Mm-hmm.
For example, is it also on your feet or just on the legs themselves?
No, it's not.
It's not on your feet?
It's on the back of the ankle, but not on the feet, no.
Okay, so we have to think of either clothing that is touching your feet
mm-hmm.
in certain areas. There tends to be more rubbing.
Mm-hmm.
Shoulders is a good example where clothes hang off the shoulder, so there's more chance of contact there, less so in the mid or lower back, more so on the upper back.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing for the abdomen. It tends to be more on the front,
mm-hmm.
less on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be some detergent, soap, something that you have been exposed to and are continuing to be exposed to
mm-hmm.
that is contributing to this rash.
Mm-hmm.
And so an allergist would be helpful to determine if there's some compound that, in the environment that's doing it. The problem is that if your arms are already inflamed and itchy,
mm-hmm.
doing a test on an arm that's itchy already is not going to help because you already have a reaction on there.
Oh, great.
So ultimately, what you have to look at is what changed in the house a month ago. It may be something so tiny that you don't even recognize it as being significant.
That's right.
But there's something that you have been exposed to do that. Again,
okay.
The reason is that not all of your body is reacting. There's certain areas that have been spared,
mm-hmm.
and usually spared areas mean either they've been protected from contact
mm-hmm.
or usually it's that. They've been protected from contact.
Mm-hmm.
So fabric softeners, detergents, perfume, soaps,
mm-hmm.
Body washes, all those kind of things you have to look at and see if any of that changed in the house
mm-hmm.
As a means of determining whether that has contributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the first step for Janet.
Okay.
Yeah, because, throwing medications at you and creams, they're designed to work, but it's the type of thing where if you're continually being exposed to what's bothering you,
mm-hmm.
it's going to keep on happening no matter what you put on the body or no matter what you take by mouth for medication.
Yeah. And I can't think, as you say, it must be so small that I don't know of any change.
So it's going to take a little bit of detective work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll put my police hat on and away we go.
All right, Janet.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye, Dr.
Bye-bye
Dr.
now. Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to line one. And Mimi and Aylmer, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor.
How are you?
There is a breast cancer screening program from the government for
yes.
women from 50 to 69.
Yes.
Well, do you understand what happened to women when they are 70? Are they free of cancer? Or why do they stop the program then?
They usually stop. I mean, the data is that you have to look at what a person's 10-year, their chance of living for another 10 years is. So if someone is screened up to age 70 and they're found to be free of breast cancer, then their average lifespan for women in Canada is around 80 years old. So that over the next 10 years, there is going to be something that can cause death in someone who is in their 70s. And so if you do screening for breast cancer, you may find that they have breast cancer, but the question is, are you going to actually prolong their life more than what their expected lifespan is to be? And so that's the issue. So you certainly can screen, but you then have to say, okay, say someone is 72 years old and you find they have breast cancer, what is the likelihood that with all the treatments and procedures that are done, what is the likelihood that you're going to prolong their life past what they were going to live anyway? And so it's done more on a statistical basis because it's an individual decision. So it's not a matter of saying you can't have a mammogram after 69. It's understanding that if we do one, what do we do with the results when we get them?
It's better not to know then.
Well, this is where it's individual decisions that are made based on that. So it's not a wrong thing to have. It's just a matter of considering what the potential outcome can be, especially if someone has heart disease or diabetes and everything else on top of it. Is this screening going to make their lives prolonged and quality of life any better?
If someone is healthy, so would it be better to have one done?
Well, again, that's an individual decision. I don't know your medical history, so this is where you have to speak with your physician to decide that, Mimi.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. My apologies to Diane in Orangeville. We have run out of time, and shingles is a very important topic. If you want to call next week, we can certainly review that. My thanks to Sebastian for producing Sunday House Call, and your calls, as always, terrific and informative. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.